This is Caffeinated Risk, the monthly podcast for security professionals by security professionals, focused on the principles of enterprise security risk management, exploring technology and business management issues and how they relate to information security risk. Once a month, two self-proclaimed grumpy security guys bring you analysis, insights, and interviews with leading security risk professionals to learn how they work through a project, a program, or their careers using a risk-based approach to security. Now, here are your hosts, Tim McCreet and Doug Leese.
Thanks for coming on board, Mike. We really appreciate it. It's been a little bit of a journey to get you on board, but we just want to thank you for being here. Can I get you to just briefly introduce your role that you have at MasterCard? And then I really want to dig into how did you get there?
Sure. First of all, you know, Tim and Doug, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here on Caffeinated Risk and share some thoughts. So, my name is Mike Lashley. I am the Deputy Chief Security Officer for MasterCard. In that role, we have a converged model. So I do both cyber and physical security for the company. So I basically have what I tell people is everything to the right of bang for MasterCard. I have all of the operational security functions for the company, everything from our, you know, protection of our executives and risk for traveler safety and protecting our data and information through our security operations center, vulnerability management programs, red teams, forensic labs, and then enterprise resilience, which for us is an all hazards response program that we have. So again, whether it's a hurricane, COVID, the war in Ukraine, or a data breach, that team steps up and does the crisis management there. So that's kind of my job here. And I am the deputy. And in addition to running all those programs, I'm the deputy for Ron Green, our chief security officer. So other duties as assigned with whatever Ron needs me to support him in, whether that's, having security conversations with our board or executives, or external engagements with customers or government partners, whatever that entails to help the company.
That's just awesome, Mike. I have lived some of those lives in past, and I get the whole other duties as required. Yeah, I think we've all lived that through most of our career. One thing I wanted to ask was, how did you get from your past life to where you are today in MasterCard? Because that's a bit of a change, right? Coming from the Secret Service, moving into MasterCard, that must have been a bit of a change for you.
It was. So I was with the Secret Service for a little over 25 years. I was with the Department of Defense, my former Marine. I was with the Department of Defense as an agent investigator for a couple of years, and then did 25 years with the Secret Service. When I first started, you think they're very different missions, but the Secret Service does both financial crimes investigations and protection of our government officials. And so when I was early on in my career, I used to do credit card investigations in the field for fraud, when fraudsters were raking credit card applications out of mailboxes and creating fraudulent accounts. So very early on, I dealt with payment companies, banks, credit card companies in working investigations. And then I moved on and focused quite a bit more on the protective side of the house. Again, I spent 11 years at the White House protecting three presidents. I worked with Presidents Clinton, Bush, and President Obama. I spent 4 years in Paris as the assistant special agent in charge there as a credentialed diplomat, helping build bridges between the operations the Secret Service had in the U.S. and our European and African partners there. And then I finished with my last role was as the special agent in charge of the technical security division. I tell people, if you ever watch James Bond, Q, the guy that invents all the really cool stuff in the basement, yep. I wasn't Q, but those really smart guys worked in my shop there. So I really had a great opportunity to work with some very high-speed technical folks. Interestingly enough, Ron Green, our current CSO, another former Secret Service agent, he and I had worked together years ago. And when he had a need for someone to come in and help support security at MasterCard, my phone rang, and here I am. So I don't find the transition all that different from a function perspective. I mean, at Secret Service, I protected people, places, and information. And I do the same thing fundamentally here at MasterCard. And so it's a very good transition and a great company to work for.
Yeah, I'm definitely a MasterCard supporter. I think I got three variations in my wallet right now.
I mean, thank you for your
I was going to say thanks for helping out, right? Sorry.
Oh yeah. The longer I'm in this business, the cyber side, the more it dawns on me. It's like, this is not a new problem. And the risk management concepts, like all of them, like even the way you boiled it down of, you know, people and information and such, this seems almost second nature to finance. They've almost been in that from day one. But in cyber, it's only the last 5-10 years we've even started talking about that. So what do you think the finance industry understands about protecting capital and people that most cybersecurity programs in other areas seem to really struggle with?
I think there's a couple of pieces to it. One is history. If you think about just the business that financial services, whether it's folks like MasterCard who are technologies companies that support those payment networks or actual banks, we've been in the business of protecting a valuable asset for hundreds of years. And so, you know, if safety and security and confidence in those transactions is core to what our business is, right? You know, that a customer walks into an appliance store with either a piece of plastic or their phone and walks out with a $2,000 or $3,000 flat screen, that transaction is going to go smoothly, and that the company is going to get their money, and that the consumer is going to get value and have an easy transaction. So it's core to what we do. So from that perspective, it's an easy conversation in that our business requires us to be safe and secure. So they support the functions of the corporate security team and other people who help keep the company secure. The other side of that, quite frankly, is regulation. We are in an extremely regulated industry, not just here in the United States, but across the globe. And so the standards that we are held to, the bar is very high. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, use that as a baseline. We don't say, okay, we've met that regulatory requirement, we're good to go. That is a baseline for us. And then we try to excel beyond that and make sure that our data, our customers' data is safe and secure at all times.
So does risk play a part of that, Mike? Because I mean, that's one of the things we've been talking about here, the podcast, at least for 3 years, but probably in our careers for 20 or more. And this idea of getting security professionals, regardless of whether they're cyber or physical, to start understanding we really are dealing with risk, and then presenting that risk message to executives. Like, do you find from the work that you've been doing at MasterCard and looking at it from those two lenses, right? What you've been in this financial space for a while now, but also understanding the regulations, does risk play a part in that? Is that part of the reason why you think you're seeing success in your program at MasterCard?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely does. And it's interesting, you know, when you talk about risk, when I was with the Secret Service, risk was, you know, someone trying to do harm to our protectees. My paradigm of that has changed going to the private sector. Risk can be many things. It could be, obviously physical risk. It could be cyber risk. It could be business, you know, could be regulatory change, geopolitical. So it really is broad. And from a business perspective, my consumers within the company, my stakeholders, all those risks are the same. They just want to make sure that they're addressed. Risk is core to how we decide how to do business at MasterCard. And it is a balance, because just like with the president, you know, we could keep the president perfectly safe, lock him in the basement of the White House. He would never be threatened. He couldn't leave the country, right? So understand what that risk is, understand the risk tolerance, and then build a program around removing or remediating that risk, but allowing the business to go forward. So that's the balance that we do here. And it is a risk tolerance conversation. Again, we could keep a money in a vault and lock it up, and it would be completely safe from anybody's any fraudster or thief. But however, we need to leverage those funds. We need to do business. And so how do we allow the company to conduct business safely and securely at business speed anywhere in the world on any platform? You know, that's my goal. That's my challenge. And, we really want to work with the business, not against the business. And I think, you know, oftentimes security, corporate security is used to being thought of as the office of no, right? Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. walk in, they ask you to do something. Let's start with no and we'll go from there. Yeah. And certainly we don't want to be that way with MasterCard. I always try to tell my teams, the answer is not no, but the answer is not like that.
Yeah, actually, I like that. That's awesome. Yeah.
So how can we be a business enabler? How can we be a consultant in safety and security to the business to say, hey, here's what you're trying to accomplish. Here's how we think is a better way to do it. And oftentimes, you know, I think it's important that we talk to our stakeholders, we understand what their end game is, and then help them build a secure product or application to get to their end game. But you really have to understand what it is that they're trying to do in the long run so we can work with them, partner with them, and not just tell them no on the front end because we don't think that's the safest way to do it.
I was listening to an interview with your former CEO, I think Ajay Banga, I think is.
Ajay Banga,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. And he had mentioned that digital innovation and service was actually a significant part of the company's success, which is what I'm hearing from you. But, you know, there seems to be a new trend around how to spend your money and make money on the internet about every 12 seconds. So is there a framework or an assessment process that you or know of or participate in so that MasterCard is, you know, making the right choices that are worth pursuing and they know very well which things to steer clear of?
Well, you know, I think one of the things we do at MasterCard is we're continuing to evolve as a company. And again, it is I think quite a misunderstanding that we are a quote unquote credit card company, right? Again, MasterCard is a technology company.
Yep.
And so we continue to evolve as a technology company. We do those core things that we've always done when it comes to processing transactions, but we're also looking at new ways to protect the ecosystem, new ways to create additional value for both public and private sector companies. How can we work with governments to enable them to create new payment flows for their citizens? We have brought on companies into MasterCard that focus on things like CipherTrace, which is focusing on cryptocurrency security. Things like, you know, Brighterion, Back and Bay. I won't go through all the M&As, but we're looking at ways continually to understand how we can make payments easier and more secure for consumers, right? We want to remove that friction, but at the same time, while we're removing that friction, we want to make sure that the payments continue to be safe and secure. Mm-hmm. And so things like, you know, I think the world is changing a little bit. So instead of walking in with a piece of plastic, signing your name to a carbon copy, which I think we're all around to remember.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Tim holding up his phone there. Yeah. It's not even just your phone, but is that your phone, Tim? Is that your phone in a place where you normally use your phone?
Yeah.
Is your phone where you are right now? Do you hold it in the correct hand? Yeah. Are you holding it in your left hand or your right hand? Are you typing with your thumbs or your fingers? The better we can understand some of those biometric movements and other ways to ensure that we have the right person on the end and it's not a fraudster making that transaction, is powerful information. It's powerful tools to secure the ecosystem. And so Doug, I hope that answers your question a little bit, but we're always continuing to push the envelope and think of new ways to make payments and new ways to make payments more secure. And if you think about things like underbanked populations, mm-hmm. and places where in developing countries, and quite frankly, there's locations even here in the United States where there are large portions of the population who do not have access to fundamental, we would consider fundamental financial tools or banking tools. We want to enable those people to do business. And if you think about, let's say, how funds from a charity get distributed in a third world country, if you deliver a suitcase of cash in some third world countries in the hope that it is going to get to the proper end users and solve the thing you were trying to solve, whether it's hunger or disease or whatever, that might work. Or if you could use an electronic transaction, secure payment through some of the offerings that, that MasterCard, as an example, has, and you can track those funds and make sure that they're getting to the end user. How are they being used appropriately to support that charity or that that disaster that you were trying to support, reducing or removing altogether fraud, which is a huge issue with those types of things. So a lot of opportunity there for us to do, again, do well by doing good in those types of economies. Mm-hmm.
This is so amazing for me because I didn't know some of the work that you folks were taking on. But I wanted to ask, I guess part of this, I mean, the question for me is how then do you keep your team current or engaged, or how do you grow the skill sets of your team, or how do you bring team members on as you start seeing some of these new projects, initiatives, or the skill set change? You know, we joked about paper transactions and carry your credit card and have it assign something to putting it on your watch or your phone now. So How do you get your team engaged or bring on folks so that you're able to deal with those risks as that new technology comes forward?
Well, look, I think, you know, the tech workforce, particularly in cybersecurity, is a huge conversation right now. And it is an issue. And it's every time I look at the statistics of how many hundreds of thousands of unfilled cybersecurity jobs there are, by the time I get ready to tell somebody about it, the number's gone up. So it is a big problem for all of us.
They keep changing the number. It's like now it's 3 to 4 million. It's like, wow, really? Okay. So,
yeah, but it's real. And of course, we struggle with it like everyone else. So the first thing we want to do is we want to provide opportunities internally for our own team, right? We want to upskill them. Right. We want to, MasterCard, pays for recurrent training and ongoing certifications and professional skills for our internal team. We also really try to push forward our internal employees. If they're an 80% solution for an opening that we have, and they have 80% of the skills we're looking for, we're going to let that internal person take that job, and then we're going to support them, get them trained up, you know, make sure they believe in themselves that they can do that job. And then that, you know, opens doors within our own company. I've got three people I can think of right off the top of my head. One person ran one of our North American facilities as a physical security director. We helped him with some education. He went and got a degree in cybersecurity. Now he runs our forensic lab.
That's cool.
Fantastic. Our cyber forensic lab, just a fantastic job. So an opportunity for a guy who was, you know, thought of as a physical security specialist, which he was, but he had other interests and we supported that. One of the people on his team used to be an administrative assistant and she showed an interest in doing some investigations. So now she's over on our corporate security investigations team. We just brought one of our regional security officers over to run crisis management for us. So one, we want to make sure that our internal folks have opportunities and we're supporting them in those ways. We also really are big supporters of veteran hiring initiatives, not just here in the United States, but all across the globe. We work through a program called Salute, as well as many other programs to really focus on those veterans, give them opportunities. They bring a huge degree of experience, skills, leadership, management. So we want to tap into that resource. Training them up is oftentimes the easiest part of that. So if we can get them to come in with that experience, we want that. We support what's known as the Cyber Talent Initiative. This one I love because few things in the world are built where everybody wins. But if you think about the Cyber Talent Initiative, right now, there are kids out there who have student loans. That's a huge topic of conversation, both here in the U.S., mostly here in the U.S., but also in other locations. What the Cyber Talent Initiative allows us to do is work with certain universities. We will pay off the student loans up to $70,000 for a student who is in a cybersecurity field. They will graduate, go to work for a government agency for 2 years, and there are certain government agencies, folks like the Secret Service, Department of Homeland Security, NSA, where they will work for that agency for 2 years, paid as a regular agency employee, and then transition to one of the partnering companies. It's MasterCard, Microsoft, Workday. So there are, you know, we were talking about significant companies there. Wow. Now, the student gets their loans paid off. The agency, who has a hard time, even a harder time than the private sector pulling in talent because they can't compete on a dollar-to-dollar aspect with salaries for the private sector, they get a constant inflow of new talent. And then we, for MasterCard, get an individual who comes to work for us who's got a degree, 2 years of experience, and is excited to come and work in a new industry. So win, win, win.
No kidding.
And then another thing is like building the next generation of cyber talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you may have heard of Girls for Tech. That's one of the big initiatives that we support.
Yep.
I love that. And I'm a father to two daughters. And so, from that perspective, anything we can do, and a new granddaughter, by the way, so maybe she'll grow up.
Congrats.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Awesome. And get a STEM education. But really, we want to help grow those areas, for young women who may not have had opportunities to or an interest in STEM type of careers in the past. So it launched in 2014. I want to say there's been over 3.5 million girls globally that have been pulled through the program, including places like Africa and the Middle East. And our goal is to reach 5 million girls by 2025. So I think that's, if we can tap into those type of resources, make tech and cybersecurity a place where people see a pathway to a career and success, that's the only way we're going to solve this problem.
We can complain about it. We can say, what are you trying to do about it? And I think that's, it's encouraging to hear that other companies with a lot more means than what we've got are genuinely doing something like this. And, what an incredible opportunity, because the fear of a student loan and the inability to pay it back would keep some people from even trying to venture down this. And, some of the people you cited that have transitioned into cyber and been very successful, it proves a theory that we've heard from a few folks now. It's more about the mindset than the how you interact with the environment. You can learn how to work the computer, but you can't learn how to think like an adversary.
Listen, I think it's a great point. And again, our threat environment is changing so rapidly that if we don't build our teams with people who want to learn, want to continue to evolve, AI, right? I'm sure you haven't gotten through a podcast in the last 6 months without somebody bringing up AI about something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though we have a lot of internal talent right now, I mean, we need to bring people on who are going to understand the threats to AI and the potential uses, positive uses of AI for us as a company. And again, the people we have on board, they're going to have to learn those skill sets. So, just having somebody who is a subject matter expert in a thing is good. And we need some of those people, but you really want people who can learn, who can evolve, who can look over the horizon and understand what the next threats are and begin to solve those problems, not just focus on today's or yesterday's problems, because it's the threat vector is changing by the hour.
Yeah. And regulation is always a lagging correction. So we can't rely on just being compliant to be safe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, and I kind of wanted to ask a follow-up to that, Mike, is that I had a chance when I was over in Rotterdam, I had a chance to spend some time with Gavin Henderson from your team. He came up with some really interesting points about the program that you have. And I wanted to ask, because he mentioned that you actually, when you're doing assessments or when you're doing projects, you bring both the physical and cyber teams together. I wanted to ask, how did that decision come along? Because I did the same at another organization I worked at. The benefit was amazing because you had two different and in some kinds of opposing viewpoints on what that risk could be. But bringing in those viewpoints was exactly what made the project better. It made the assessment better. It gave more light to things that we weren't thinking of. So I'm kind of curious, how does that process work now within the MasterCard environment?
Yeah, so listen, Tim, we have a converged, as I mentioned before, a cyber and physical team. So folks like Gavin, who runs all of our regional security officers, they have skills both individually and on their teams that cover both aspects. Now, listen, everybody's going to be stronger on one side or the other. We don't expect everybody to be able to crack open your Dell and find the ransomware, as well as you jump in front of a speeding car for the CEO, right?
Yeah.
So we understand that there's going to be, you're going to have your strengths. But at the same time, we want everybody to be able to support both missions. And so it really goes back to, again, the Secret Service, as I mentioned, Ron Green also came from there. If you look back maybe 15 years or maybe a little bit more ago, let's say that the president was coming to your office building to give a speech, and we would do the things we always did. We would bring in the counter snipers. We would bring in the bomb dogs. We would bring in men and women with guns to stand in front of the doors and protect it. But we realized that with the Internet of Things, there were other threats there that we really needed to address. You can imagine what those might be, but maybe as an example, somebody could hack into a CCTV system and follow our movements, you know, about the campus. Yep. So the Secret Service went back to the cyber crimes division and brought some of that talent, some of those cyber crimes investigators back over to the protective side of the house and said, hey, when we go out, help us protect from these cyber threats that are out there. Well, when Ron came to MasterCard, he looked at MasterCard and he kind of did the same thing, but from an opposite approach. And he said, hey, listen, we may have the best firewalls and malware intrusion detection, but if I leave the server door unlocked, we haven't secured the company. So we realize that it is a holistic approach to security that really needs to be looked at today. We also, at least from our perspective, we see that, you know, cyber and physical threats are converging.
Uh-huh.
No longer is cyber just an attack on your data or network. Let's look at Colonial Pipeline as an example. That had a very real world physical impact on safety and security when those pipelines were shut down. Think about attacks on hospitals that are now, not just stealing data, but shutting down systems that are keeping people alive. And so there's a physical security threat there. Potential attacks on power grids and data centers and networks. When we look at threats from nation states, cyber has become a function of war now. And so that is a precursor to then the physical aspects that or kinetic attacks that will come behind that cyber attack. So the two things are intertwined in our world today.
Uh-huh.
Also, in our response process, our crisis management process, we kind of have a holistic view of it. Again, going back to my old world when I did investigations, I think fundamentally, I know don't over-rotate on this, but fundamentally, all investigations are the same. If you're doing a bank fraud case or a homicide or a kidnapping, the fundamental principles of investigation are the same. Now, you bring in different experts.
Yep, agreed.
And there are some subtleties, but fundamentally, your approach is the same in an investigation. And so for us, our crisis management process is the same. And we have a core crisis management, kind of an all hazards approach with a framework that then we bring different battle plans to address the issue, whether it's a cyber attack, keeping our citizens our employees safe in Ukraine during the invasion. Maybe it's a hurricane in Florida or a data breach or COVID. But our approach is the same. And so that team does both cyber and physical threats. Same thing with insider threat. I don't think as a cybersecurity professional or as a physical security professional, I can separate the threats to MasterCard from an insider threat perspective into neat pots, right?
Right.
Again, if you're going to have a physical threat to the company, they're probably also maybe trying to steal data, maybe trying to do damage to your networks before they leave or do other things. So, again, we see those two things as being very complementary. Now, I would also offer this. It works really well for us.
Okay. Yeah, fair.
I think it works really well for certain sized companies. Maybe if you're a bank with 400,000 employees and 30,000 branch banks and ATMs across the company, and you have a guard force of thousands of people, perhaps you might want to look at a different model.
Right.
But for a company the size of MasterCard, highly tech focused, protecting data centers, people, and personnel is a great business model for us. Again, happy to talk to anybody about how we saw that journey and what the benefits have been for us.
Actually, yes. Thank you for offering. That was the question that I had. It's really difficult, I think, because we're still often confronting a lot of siloed thinking. A camel is a racehorse designed by a committee. And a lot of these early version convergence centers seem like more like a camel than a racehorse. Not that a camel's a bad thing. I mean, it's got a place, but it wasn't what we thought we were getting. What would be a good approach for a company that's trying to build such a thing? I'm sure you've built a couple camels or been involved in them, and how to avoid said steps or reduce the size of the hump and maybe get them a little faster out of the gate.
Some people might even suggest that there's a donkey or two in the mix there.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. Yeah.
So, well, listen, you know, we kind of took the government approach to some aspects. So if you think back, you know, after 9/11, the U.S. government realized that there was a lot of intelligence out there that might have provided more information or more awareness to the attacks before they happened, right? But it wasn't, there was no place to bring all that information together. One of the things that I did when I was at the Secret Service, I had the honor of as a supervisor, both working in and overseeing the Joint Operations Center there at the White House, which again gives a good broad view of all the different elements of people that need to protect the White House. So when I came to MasterCard, I realized that we had a very highly qualified and energetic crisis management group, but when we had a problem, they would stand up in the middle of the room and have to, hey, someone, we need to get a conference room over there to talk. And hey, by the way, we need a lawyer to give us an opinion on this. And can somebody find out where the application owner is? And it worked, but it could be more efficient. So we built in St. Louis our MasterCard Fusion Center. And the idea was, listen, when we have this crisis, let's have all the people or all the elements that we need in the same room. 80% of the time, 70% of the time, they're going to do their day job. But when a crisis happens, they all pivot to the center of the room and they start to work on the problem. Okay. And so now our crisis manager who is running the issue, he needs a legal opinion. I've got a lawyer sitting 3 feet to the left of him. We need to write a communications, whether it's internal for our employees or our management or our customers. We don't have not a highly technical person or maybe a security. We have a comms expert who's going to take that data, boil it down into something digestible and help put that stakeholder product out for everybody. We have our business and customer fraud teams in the room. So if it's attack on MasterCard, perhaps it might be that information might be important to one of our customers or consumers or vice versa. And that was the intent. And when we first built the Fusion Center, it worked very well. We actually cut our response times by 2/3. So a thing that used to take us a day to solve, we were solving in 2 or 3 hours. A thing that used to take us a week to solve, we were solving in 2 or 3 days. So it worked fantastically. But when we built it, what we didn't realize was there were going to be tangential benefits. And so this is maybe we thought was going to be a camel, but became the accidental thoroughbred. When you put 18 or 25, I think we're up to 28 different business elements now in our Fusion Center from across the company. First of all, there is no place across the company that has a better 30,000 foot view of what's going on across the entire enterprise every day than in that Fusion Center. And so we began to have this really good understanding of just whether it's business threats, geopolitical issues. It is a font of information because it might not be that I'm having a conversation with a customer fraud person. Maybe I'm talking about something else, but then their ears perk up and go, hey, wait a minute. We're seeing that same thing in Africa. What do you know about it? And you begin to tie those threads together. So that's the first benefit.
Right.
The second benefit was we have very strong relationships, big believers in the public-private partnerships, intelligence sharing, information sharing with law enforcement, with intelligence across the globe. So we had those strong ties where we were talking to people learning about threats to MasterCard. And as I said before, we began to realize that these things that we were gathering to protect our own enterprise could save our customers from fraud and from attacks. And so by taking that information, and again, it has to be done quickly. And that's where the secret sauce is in the Fusion Center. Mm-hmm. When we first began to hear about that and say, hey, wait a minute, this sounds like it might be important to a customer, we would pass it to the business fraud teams. And they would call a bank and say, hey, we think you're the victim of a cash out attack or a bust out attack, if you're familiar with the term. And we would stop it. And they say, oh, my gosh, we've lost $7 or $10 million. But thank you. And we've shut the door. We got that process down where then after about 6 months, it was, hey, you know, a cash out attack has just started on you. OK, oh, my gosh, we've lost about $1 million, but we stopped it. And then we got to the point where you're about to be the victim of a fraud attack. And we were able to stop that right off the bat. We're taking, you know, again, fusing the things that are good for MasterCard with the things that are good for our our customers and stakeholders.
Thanks so much, Mike, for all of this. I know this has just been fascinating. And I just want to thank you for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Tim and Doug, again, thank you both. It was a fabulous conversation. I appreciate I appreciate your time as well and your patience in getting this pulled together. And I wish you both the best. Have a great, safe weekend.
Thank you, sir. You betcha. Thanks for listening to the latest podcast from Caffeinated Risk. Make sure you visit our website, caffeinatedrisk.com, to stay up to date on what we've been working on. Our website has bios of our podcast guests, posts about topics we're passionate about, and even a library reference material we find valuable in the work we do every day. And don't forget to subscribe to Caffeinated Risk on your favorite podcast service. This way, you'll be notified when we release our next podcast, and you can listen to our previous guests just in case you missed them. Thanks so much for listening to Caffeinated Risk.